Thank you very much. It's been nice to spend the past few months here at the ITP and away from the snow in Boston. I thought I would talk about this topic, not because it is something that I'm doing currently, but because I thought it may be useful to see some of the attempts that we had from the condensed matter and statistical physics part to generalize theories from polymers to things that were higher dimensional objects. And also because one of my earlier collaborators in this field and my last collaborator are currently at the ITP, so I thought that was appropriate. Terry Huaven, who was a graduate student before he became more interested in biology, did some of this work, and Kai Wiese, who has recently joined the ITP here, did some of the last things that I will mention are attempts to generalize field theories using these extensions. So what I will start is to give you a brief introduction to essentially all you need to know about statistical mechanics of polymers, and you probably know that already, and then to gradually try to go to objects that are more complicated, such as surfaces, and show why there are multiple universality classes, and we have to specify some particular type of surface that we are interested in, and talk about its continuum formulation, and if there is time, we'll go back and talk about these generalizations of field theory. So, as a statistical mechanician, I tell my graduate students always that everything comes back down to the central limit theorem, and so this whole field you can think of as some extension of the central limit theorem, whose manifestation for polymers would be to start thinking about a random walk as the simplest example of what a polymer is. So you start at some point on a lattice, and you basically take some kind of a random tour. And this is step 0, step 1, step 2, etc. After n steps, you end up at some location that is, let's say, a distance r away. And the central limit theorem tells us that the number of configurations or the weight of walk of n steps ending up at some separation r is proportional to the exponential of, it has a Gaussian form, so it goes like r squared, and let's say there's a variance that has the number of steps, and if we call some characteristic short distance a, it would have this kind of form. Now this is of course valid if you are in one dimension, two dimensions, any number of dimensions. There is a normalization factor that depends on the number of dimensions for this Gaussian. Okay, so this is a zeroth order description of a polymer, which is a linear object, and you can then start to refine this. So one of the first refinements that you may want to put down is bending. You can say, okay, this is a model on a lattice, maybe I want to think of my polymer as something that is really in the continuum, so my units, rather than being steps on the lattice, I allow them to basically be unit vectors that are moving in the continuum. And secondly, I noticed that most of the time if I want to bend something, there's going to be some kind of a cost, so I give a minimum energy configuration to when things are parallel, and I cause some kind of cost for bending. So there is some kind of a rigidity. So clearly the zero energy configuration for an object like this would be when everything is straight like a rod. But as you all know, when you go to finite temperatures because of entropy and fluctuations, this object becomes really at long distances like a macaroni. So what you can do is you can quantify that by, say, introducing some kind of a tangent at each point. So this is the first step that you are taking. And this is, let's say, after x steps. And if you were to look at the correlation between the angles after taking so many steps, this is like a one-dimensional system, it's going to decay exponentially with how far away you go, and there is some characteristic length scale here that is called the persistence length. Now, does this change things? If I were to, modify this picture, I could say that let's actually take the log of that and define something like a free energy of this W. So it's minus my log of W.
Is there an A in there as well? Is that the lattice?
I put it over here. So my X is some number like 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, okay.
Actually, maybe I should call this N so that there is no confusion. Yeah. Okay, so this, if I were to take this, it's going to be R squared over NA squared. Let's forget the factors of 2 and things like that. But the realization now is that actually things are kind of correlated. The angles are not independent until you reach this length scale of the order of C. So essentially, the number of independent units that you want to look at, rather than being n, is reduced by a factor of a over c. And the size of the step at which things become uncorrelated and you can regard them as being random steps has changed now. Rather than being a, is this factor of c. So I have a c squared here. And if I call n a, the total length of this object, to be l, you can see that this goes like R squared over LC. So basically, the structure is again like a Gaussian. So it seems like you are connecting the two endpoints of this with a Gaussian Hookean spring, and the mean fluctuations in R squared are growing always. R squared grows like L, and all the rigidity does, it makes the P factor bigger. But that's one aspect of trying to make the polymer more realistic. A more important aspect is the monomer-monomer interaction. And the statement is that, of course, if you have something like a polymer and you bend it in space, it cannot cross itself. There's some constraint that two monomers cannot go through each other, or more generally, there could be some kind of an interaction between monomers on the polymer that are not neighboring each other, they're far apart. And presumably, if I were to model this on a picture like this, I would have to eliminate a loop such as here. So I would have to look at self-avoiding box rather than all box, and the self-avoiding constraint being something that is non-local makes computations and doing something like this difficult. Fortunately, there is a very good scaling argument that is due to Flory, which goes something like this. He says, let's look again at this free energy. And if we just include the entropy factor, the number of blocks, etc., what we get is this R squared over LC. But now there is this interaction, this excluded volume, self-avoidance, whatever you might want to call it. And that is an effect between pairs of objects. So he says, let's try to estimate that as an energy cost that is proportional to the density of the object. So the density is proportional to the length divided by R to the D if we regard our polymer as being confined to some size R. In D dimension, then the volume is R to the D. Density is the number of monomers L divided by R to the D. You look at density squared, multiply by volume, and let's put some kind of a coefficient here. So this term, R squared over L psi, prefers the R's to be small because small configurations have more entropy. This term wants it to be expanded because small configurations have a lot of self-avoidance and energy. So So once you balance these two, you will find that R goes like L to the some exponent that we call mu f, and this Fleury exponent mu f is 3 divided by d plus 2. If I were to make a table of what that exponent is, as a function of dimension, so this is the Fleury mu, and let's call this exact, although we don't always have exact values. So let's go 1, 2, 3, 4 dimensions. Fleury gives you 1, 3 quarters, 3 fifths, 1 half, and the best values I can put here are 1. Okay. So first of all, you note that this exponent that we have over here, when we reach dimensions of 4, at 4 it becomes 1 half, which is what you have for a random walk. And in fact, if you go above 4 dimensions, this minimization is not going to be relevant because already the entropy factor tells you that R is going to be expanded like a random walk. So above 4, the exponent sticks to a value of 1 half, and this is therefore the upper critical dimension. While at another lower critical dimension, 1, which we call DL, the object, because of self-avoidance in one dimension, has to go straight. It cannot fluctuate, so the thing becomes again trivial. In two dimensions, the predictions of this Fleury theory is 3/4, and we strongly believe that that's an exact exponent. In three dimensions, Fleury theory predicts 0.6, which is very close to what is the outcome of many simulations, some experiments, etc., which is 0.589. So the actual value is slightly smaller than what this estimate gives, and actually I'm sort of emphasizing this because part of what I will be talking about is how to get precise exponents like this better than, say, the 3/5 that comes from this kind of argument.
Why is it exact in 2?
Why is it exact in 2? It's you cannot start with something like the self-avoiding polymer and solve it. There is a mapping, which I will also talk about, to the n goes to 0 limit of 5/4 theory. And Nienhuis showed that 5/4 theory in turn is equivalent to some picture of loops in two dimensions, which you can then map to a surface in two dimensions. And then for a fluctuating surface, if you know one rigidity parameter, you can calculate all of the exponents. And Nienhuis made a conjecture about the relationship between the n of O(n) theory and what that rigidity parameter is, and from that you get this value. Okay.
But that's a statement about the critical point in the 5/4 theory in two dimensions.
Yes.
For n goes to 0.
Yes.
Vanishing anomalous dimension, or just the 6/4?
No, it has anomalous dimensions from one of which you can extract this 3/4. And actually, the exponents are known for...
3/4 mean field?
No, no.
It's
1/2. Mean field is 1/2. So this Fleury theory indeed has lots of aspects that remind you of mean field theory. So that's probably why you're asking if this is some kind of a mean field, but it doesn't translate into a standard mean field theory for O(n) models. If we could do that, then that would be wonderful. If you could get the Ising model in three dimension to this degree of accuracy from some kind of mean field theory,
yes.
You can't. Okay? So over here, I implicitly assumed that there was a repulsion. But sometimes there's also an attraction, and in fact the general potential that you can have between monomers presumably has an excluded volume when the particles come in contact, but it could have an attractive part, and if the attraction dominates, you have to put a minus sign here, but actually maybe I will, you have to put a minus sign here to indicate. if you have attraction. And then the minimization would go to zero unless you add a three-body interaction for stability that goes something like this. And in that case, when you minimize it, you will find that you will have a finite density for a compact object whose mu is 1 over d. So basically, there is some kind of a simple phase diagram for polymers as a function of this parameter v. For v positive, as we've discussed, you have a phase in which mu is larger than 1/2. You can think of it as a swollen polymer. If it is attractive, it becomes highly compact, and mu is 1 over d. And there is a transition between the two of them, which you can induce by changing temperature in polymers, etc., and it's called a theta point. And in three dimensions, mu at the theta point would be 1/2, because fluctuations would be kind of unimportant. Okay, so that's what I wanted to do first. We've gone through this introduction to polymers. Now, one thing that is now quite tempting is to try to generalize and see what we can say about surfaces. Now, for polymers, basically the phase diagram really as simple as this. You can't really do much more. Well, to zero, I guess you could do additional things like long-range interactions, etc. Let's ignore those things. So for surfaces, however, the situation is more complicated. You can imagine putting some bunch of particles together so that instead of having a linear object, you form a two-dimensional surface and ask, well, how much can you say about such objects? And the first thing that you note is that you have to be very careful about specifying how you've put these particles together, what the constraints are on the internal structure. And on one limit, you can put the particles such that they can move around. And the simplest example of a two-dimensional surface that jumps to my mind, for example, is a soap film. If you put a bubble on a frame, it becomes stretched. And of course, the reason it becomes stretched is that you have an energy cost that is some surface tension, sigma times the area. And that's really the dominant thing that keeps this thing flat. Something that is does not have that much surface tension is the lipid bilayer that, for example, can be formed by mixing oil and water or what you have as cell membranes. And for cell membranes, actually, the surface tension is very small, and the energy is dominated rather by some rigidity, bending rigidity. Let's call it kappa, times the integral of curvature squared. Again, this is a simplified picture. You could have additional things. And people have studied these class of surfaces a lot, and again, evaluated what the equivalent of the persistence length is in one dimension. You can figure out what it is in two dimensions. But again, this class of surfaces basically maintains their flatness up to some characteristic length scale, and beyond which it becomes kind of crumpled. So in that sense, it has something in common with these polymers. At the other extreme, rather than allowing the particles that you have put together to make the surface to move with respect to each other, you can basically fix their positions relative to their neighbors and make an object that is flat. So the simplest example of that would be this sheet of paper. So for this sheet of paper, the particles are sort of definitely joined to their neighbors in a specific way, and no matter how you move it around, that is fixed and maintained. So one example is basically paper. Second example, actually again, one can find a biological analog of that. The red blood cell, in addition to having this fluid membrane, since it has to go through capillaries and emerge and maintain its shape, also has on top of it a skeleton, which is something like a triangular network of molecules, actually at a large scale. So basically, if this is the thing, then there's structure like this that is maintaining its shape, and as it goes through capillaries and emerges, it can come bounce back again. And a third example, which is something that Terry Hua came up with when he was a graduate student and actually did experiments involving explosions of the lab of Toyo Tanaka, was graphite sheets. Basically, in graphite, you have two-dimensional sheets that are strongly covalently bonded and weak bonds between them. So you can try to oxidize those sheets, and that's where the explosion comes, and get individual sheets of graphite, and that's what Terry did. And actually, that experiment was repeated later on here at UCSB also. Now, actually, from this point on, I'm going to entirely focus on this class of surfaces, and that's probably where I will lose the interest of string theorists, because it means that I'm dealing with objects in which the metric is fixed. So I'm not allowing any fluctuations in the metric, and that allows me to go much further with the theory and do nice things. But it's a very specific class of surfaces. Okay? So over here, I had this simplified phase diagram for polymers. I can do something similar for these surfaces. I can imagine that there is, in addition to these connectivity issues that we discussed, some kind of an interaction between different particles that make up this surface, and ask what happens as I go through zero, presumably by analogy with what we have on the right for polymers. If the interaction is repulsive, you expect the object to be swollen. And if it is attractive, you expect it to be compact. And in fact, this was the kind of transition that Terry Hua was trying to observe in these graphite sheets. But for the case of polymers, we were able to completely ignore bending rigidity, and we said that the effect of that vanishes beyond some persistence length. That is not the case for surfaces. And if I were to introduce another axis here, which is bending rigidity, what I will find is that at small values of bending, I will have some kind of a swollen object like this. If I make it resist bending, so I have some kind of a rigidity, I know that at low temperatures it would like to be flat, and in fact there is a real phase transition between something that is crumpled and something that is flat. So this is swollen and crumpled, as opposed to a phase that is flat and you have a structure like this. Of course, it is when it is flat, I don't exclude it having ripples on top of it, but still you can define some kind of a long-range order parameter like the direction of the norma, etc. And in fact, if you then take this flat object and put some kind of attraction, what we showed in simulation is that the first thing that it happens is that it maintains the flatness but folds once and then folds again. And so presumably here what you have are a whole lot of folded faces. Okay, so why this phase diagram is more complicated is actually interesting to think about. Again, at the zeroth order, you may have imagined that the flat phase that you have here is something in which the normals have obtained some kind of long-range order, but it's an ordering in two dimensions, so you may have said that if I introduce bending and Goldstone modes, that order will vanish in two dimensions because of fluctuations, but this has a way of avoiding that because of some coupling of the different Goldstone modes. Okay? Fine. So where would one get some kind of a phase diagram like this? So far it was kind of hand-waving, so let me go now and give you some kind of continuum formulation. So let's again go back and think in terms of the polymer. So the polymer, we think of something like this, where previously I had the monomer numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. But one thing that I can do in trying to go towards a continuum is to replace the discrete monomer numbers with a continuous index that goes along the polymer. So my x is something that goes between, say, 0 and L. And then indicate the location of the monomer labeled by x by a vector R of x, where R is something that lives in d-dimensional space, so it has d components. Okay? So the question is, what is the weight that I can assign to some particular curve R of x, some particular configuration of the polymer that I have described? Okay? Now, the answer to that is, this kind of central limit theorem told me that if I look at things that are sufficiently large number of monomers apart, it is like they are connected by a spring. So if I want to write the weight for a spring, it would be R at one point minus R at the next point, square that, and the continuum version of it is just the integral 0 to L dx with some coefficient spring constant dr by dx dot dr by dx. Okay? Now, of course, the central limit theorem is always valid only for large number of monomers between, and you may wonder about, well, how big a size I have to get, etc. Essentially, what the central limit theorem says is that there could indeed be corrections to this. I could add here terms like u dr by dx to the fourth power. I can add things like kappa over 2 d2r by dx squared. All of these things are allowed by symmetry. And essentially, what I find is that if I look at the thing at sufficiently large scale, all of these terms can be ignored in some sense, and I'm left with this Hookean type of expression. So can we take over the same kind of picture to to describe one of these fluctuating ruled surfaces. Okay, so here is my surface. And I can describe it again through a vector r, but now with two components, x1 and x2, to label the two x's that I can pick up. And if you think of this as some kind of an effective weight or Hamiltonian, you can ask, well, what is the corresponding two-dimensional Hamiltonian? Now, in two dimension, the problem is you don't have the analog of the central limit theorem. The central limit theorem essentially allows you to integrate some number of degrees of freedom and get an interaction between what remains. In two dimensions, the connectivity doesn't allow you to do that, but you can still appeal to symmetries and, for example, write terms that are very similar to what we have here. So the first term would be d2x, d alpha r, where you have to sum over alpha equals to 1 and 2. And actually, let me put this here. We will have the analogs of these higher order terms. There are two of them. And the higher order derivative, which is something like a rigidity. Now, the phase diagram that I have on the right can be obtained partially from a mean field treatment.
So, Mark, did you worry about a symmetry under changing coordinates on the surface?
What symmetry do I have here?
Well, x1 and x2 are.
If I have something like rotational symmetries, etc., I have to make sure that I implement them. So this expression is certainly symmetric under the exchange of x1 and x2. When I come to higher order terms, I have to be more careful.
This is a rigid structure.
Yeah, but even within a rigid structure, there are choices. And if I have a square lattice symmetry as opposed to an isotropic, then there are actually additional terms that appear here. Okay. But basically, that's it. There's nothing else I can add. Okay? And the way that I can get a phase transition in this model is by making K change sign. If K becomes negative, then it is like a spring that rather than becoming like this wants to expand, and then positive higher order terms are necessary to stabilize, and what that gives you is some kind of a flat structure. So by really having this parameter minus k here go through zero, you can get the phase diagram that I have indicated over there. And the interesting question then is to show, because I would have said the same thing at mean field level also for the one-dimensional system, to show why fluctuations destroy this phase in one dimension but not in two dimensions. Okay? So, but that's really part of the story, because if that's it, I'm really walking along the axis that is B equals to zero, no interaction between monomers or particles that are far apart along the metric. So how do I generalize that? And that's something that is called, for polymers, the Edwards model. And basically, what you say is that your probability for a configuration of the polymer has a part that is the description of the connectivity, entropy effect, etc., which is this integral dr by dx squared with a positive k. And, well, how do we describe the fact that particles that are far apart along this curve don't want to interact? That's going to be a non-local term in this theory, so we need to add a term like integral dx dx prime, a delta function in b-dimensional space that prevents or penalizes the contact between the two points. Okay? So it's sort of a softening of the non-crossing condition or the hard core condition by giving it really a penalty. Okay? So what can we do with this kind of a theory? Well, then we can do some scaling analysis or dimensional analysis. Ultimately, what we are after is that if I have something that is of length L, it occupies some region that grows like L to the mu, and what is that mu? Scaling would be to replace all factors of X by rescaling B, and to be consistent with that, to replace all of my R's with B to the mu R. If I just do this simple rescaling of variables, what happens to my parameters? K and V now will pick up factors of B that I will label YK and YV, and simple counting tells you that YK, well, you have two R's, so you have two mu, and you have one derivative, but two derivatives here and one integration, so that's a net minus one. And the repulsion term here, you have two integrations because you're basically looking at two potential monomers, and the dimension of a delta function is minus d times the dimension of what we have there. Okay, this is something we'll come back to. So what kind of scaling variant theories could we have if we didn't have the interaction term? The Gaussian one would be fine, in which we set yk to 0, and that gives us the random walk exponent of 1 half. And if you ask, well, are the interactions relevant at this point or not, you can substitute 1 half into that expression, and you get 2 minus d over 2, which is something that changes sign at 4 dimension. It's called the deviation from 4 dimension epsilon. Basically, above 4 dimension it is irrelevant, below 4 dimension it is relevant. And then one of the things that you can do is an expansion. So there is a method to do perturbation in this parameter V, and then reorganize it in a renormalization group around the dimension when this thing becomes relevant, and your mu is 1 half, and the first correction is epsilon over 16, and the next one is 15 over 512 epsilon squared, and you have higher order terms. Okay? So that's a successful theory that one has for describing self-avoidance effects in polymers. Can we do the same thing for surfaces? So let's, questions? So let's try it for surfaces.
And this is another way of doing the OMO independent.
Yes,
zero.
It's a more direct way, right? Yeah. Right. So the other one.
It's equivalent, yeah, that's right.
Yes, one can show to all orders in perturbation theory that this expansion. So there's lots of formal work done in showing this identity.
Is this a spike to the fourth
order? This is equivalent to an n goes to zero limit of phi to the fourth theory. I'll come to that, so we'll see.
Yeah, but because the polymer just goes around.
Right. I'll come to that, don't worry. Okay, so the two-dimensional version of it, you would write two terms. Again, as long as you are in the swollen phase, now you can write dr dx squared, and you have a two-point interaction term. Like this. And let's continue and do our analysis with dimensions like we did over here. So if I rescale all x's by some factor b, all r's by a factor of mu, the yk here will get again 2 mu, but I have two integrations and two derivatives, so that's it. Now yv, I have four integrations, and I have my delta function with dimension new. So that's how those things get modified. Now the problem is, if I'm looking for some kind of a Gaussian theory in which interactions are irrelevant, if I set my k equals to zero, I will get a new equals to zero, which in fact, if you do things more carefully, it really means that r squared grows like log l. But it's the zero limit of an exponent. But then you ask, well, is this ever a valid construct? And then you evaluate your YV at this point, and you find that it is 4, and it is always positive. And so you conclude that basically the two-dimensional object has so much connectivity, it becomes so crumpled, it only grows logarithmically. It's such a crumpled object that no matter how high your dimension, the interactions are always relevant and will expand you. And so you have no upper critical dimension, and you're left with how you're going to try to construct a perturbative theory that is meaningful and calculate exponents, etc., because your upper critical dimension is infinite. Okay? So what's the resolution? The resolution is, we are going to generalize the model. How am I going to do that? Well, I went from a one-dimensional object to a two-dimensional object, but why not consider an object that is intermediate? So I introduce a vector x that moves in d capital dimensions, where if I set d equals to 1, I have polymers. If I set d equals to 2, I have these surfaces. But in general, I could try to think about all kinds of these. The probability for a configuration is going to be just a generalization of this. So I basically, all my integrations now become d-dimensional. And let's see what our yk and y nu are in this case. Then the yk, let me erase these, is 2 mu's, because I have still 2 r's. I have integration in d dimension, and then I have minus 2 from having 2 derivatives. And my yv is 2d because of the 2 dimensional interactions, minus d mu. Right? So let's look at our Gaussian fixed point. So yk, we set that equal to 0, and what it gives us is mu 0, which is 2 minus d over 2. Okay? Interpolates between 1/2 and 0 as you change from 1 to 2 dimensions. And actually, you can translate this to some kind of a fractal dimension, ask what's the fractal dimension of this, in the same sense that the Hausdorff dimension of a random walk is 2, and the generalization is 2d, 2 minus d, becomes infinite for the surface, which is a very compact object. Well, is this ever a valid description? Let's look at the relevance of the interactions at this Gaussian point, and that is given by 2d minus d over 2 minus d. And so you see that we've identified an upper critical dimension for this class of theories, which is 4d divided by 2 minus d, which is in fact twice the fractal dimension. And basically, you could, in principle, find ranges where you have an upper critical dimension. The physical meaning of this upper critical dimension twice the fractal dimension is, of course, so simple geometric. You have relevance when two curves that have this dimension can intersect, and that first happens in dimension that is twice the fractal dimension. Okay. So let me plot for you what this looks like. So this is 0, 1, 2, and 2 is in fact an asymptote, and the curve that we have here is something like this. And roughly, it intersects one-dimensional objects or polymers at the standard upper critical dimension, that is 4. And here you have, let's say, 2, 3, 1. The curve at 2 is 2/3. At 3, it is 5/6. And here it is 1. Basically, what it says is that if you are to the right of this, that's the region where the Gaussian fixed point is valid. So you have your mu 0 is 2 minus d over 2. But once you go beyond that curve, you have to take care of interactions and see what happens. The points of interest to us, of course, in three-dimension polymers and surfaces, and let's say in two-dimensions polymers, and somehow we want to get some value for the use of these points. Now, the standard way to do polymeric expansions and also field theory expansions is, of course, the expansion around four dimension, where you basically are forced to move towards your points of interest along this line. But now we have a more general theory, and we could, in principle, expand around any point on this line. And in fact, the expansion, let's call this variable epsilon over 2, we can carry out. And to zeroth order going away from this line, we have 2 minus d over 2 plus some parameter mu 1, which is a function of your expansion point, times epsilon, potentially some other one, epsilon squared, etc. So the first order expansion is what we calculated with Nelson in 87, and simultaneously was done by Aronowitz and Lubensky. And the second order had to wait until 96, because it's much more complicated structure, and David and Wiese were able to do that. So these functions now exist, and you can use them to calculate or try to estimate these exponents, etc. Let's see what. Yeah? How we do this? It's actually an interesting thing, because we encounter some of the same things that you would in trying to go from say field theory to perturbations for other higher extended objects. Because if you like the perturbation theory that you have for polymers, you start with a random walk and you calculate the endpoint separation from this r squared over n that I told you. But then you say, oh, I made a mistake, because there's the chance that this walk intersects itself, so I have to subtract that. And you subtract that diagram, and you get a correction term. In fact, there are two such diagrams. There is something that looks like this, and there's another one. I won't get it right, but maybe there's only one. Yeah, okay. At higher order, there are more topologically distinct graphs. So let's say if you are dealing with the interaction between two objects, you could have something that has a bubble, and then the bubble interacts with some other polymer, or you could have an interaction how come I have difficulty, that goes something like this, and you have a bubble. But anyway, once we go to trying to calculate objects like manifolds, actually what we do is we calculate the probability that two points are in contact or at some separation in some infinite manifold. So what we are interested are things like e to the I k dot r at some point minus r at zero. Okay? And these objects, and when you insert factors of this interaction, the interaction is a delta function. The delta function can be written as an exponential of this form, so you will have additional k's at different points. And then this evaluated with a Gaussian expectation value is like the Coulomb interaction of a set of charges. And then what you have to do is you have to screen the charges appropriately, etc. And what it has in common with generalizing field theories to say string theories, that classes of diagrams that for polymer objects are distinct because of topology here all merge together, because on the two-dimensional manifold there is no natural ordering of going one way or the other.
So here you can't, there's no way of writing this as the n equals 0 limit.
It's not the n goes to 0 limit of a string, a field theory. Yeah.
You just do it.
Right. Exactly. And so what, if I were to get to the last stage, what we did was a reverse engineering. We said this is, let's say this is the n goes to 0 limit of some theory, which is not a field theory. What is that theory? We can give a perturbative definition of that theory, but it's not a field theory and we can't write it as Hamilton. Okay?
This is for a V in positive range, right?
This is in the V positive range, yes.
So, for V, change a lot if I change the sign of the flip
exponents? Yeah, because if you change the sign of the V, they think...
flip exponents.
If you change the sign of the interaction term V, the structure of the object wants to be compact. So one thing that you need to do is for stability, you have to add higher order terms. Once you include that and then you do appropriate theory, you will regain U equals to 1 over D. So in the compact phase is actually trivial. The transition between the two of them is not, and you can try to get an expansion for that. Okay? So let me explain one feature of this, which is that you can ask, I want to look at polymers or surfaces in three dimensions, where should I expand about? I mean, previously, you knew you were coming here, but now, I mean, this point is as good a priori as any other point. So one of the things that, again, Terry Hua did was to try to answer this. And so the general idea, the details become kind of complicated, so let's not hopefully get pinned on that, is to try to calculate this nu by expansion around around all of these points D, and look at how it behaves. And let's say it behaves something like this. Then the idea is that the place where you have minimal sensitivity to your expansion point, where you have an extremum, is some well-specified point.
D is not the point you're expanding.
Yes. Yeah. I could look for polymers that are sitting here, which is sitting at some particular value of epsilon. But this capital D and mu one of D can change as I move along this line. So once I substitute them in this equation, I will get a function of D for my estimate of what the mu is for polymer or surface in three dimensions. Uh-huh. And so which point should I choose? Well, one has to have some criterion. One criterion is minimal sensitivity to expansion point, which means that you look at an extremum. And actually, the interesting thing is that looking at this picture, you might have guessed that if I do that for polymers here, the closest point for the expansion would be around here. Turns out that the extremum comes out around here. Yeah. And there is some reason to understand that about, which again, Kai Wiese has developed about the structure of these perturbation series and their Borel summability, etc. And the structure is most convergent, essentially, around this point.
And that's going to equal 1, but
Actually, for epsilon for the polymers is 1. Here it is 2. Here it is 8 for surfaces.
Does this actually give an analytic function that agrees with the epsilon expansion?
Yes. Yeah. So these are analytic, but this one is certainly.
This means of extrapolating into the plane.
Yeah.
That gives an analytic function.
Yes.
It must have singularities if you move far enough away.
It's a around this line. It's a standard asymptotic series. So it has actually what Kai has shown is that it has the same kind of convergence problems as you would have for the standard expansion, except that you can calculate what the typical number of terms is that you need in an asymptotic expansion, and the best number turns out to be around here.
Four polymers.
Actually independent, because it's a character of the expansion, if you like. It's, for surfaces, it's like, I mean, this, when you do these curves with one or two, of course you get different curves, but most of the time you get some dimension between 1.2 and 1.5 for these expansions.
Excuse me, I'm confused. That's a statement about nu 1?
That's a statement about empirically observed by looking at how nu 1 and nu 2 behave, and then further bolstered by figuring out the dimension, well, the typical way that the higher order terms in the series behave. So trying to guess what some kind of a good radius for expansion number falls. Okay? And just to give you numbers, for polymers, you get, depending on the scheme that you use, already something like 0.58 or 0.59 when you do one loop or two loop expansion. So the results are not, if you properly interpret them, not too sensitive to second order, which is actually much better than what you would have gotten for the standard expansion around the field theory. For surfaces, the answer is actually are not as good and consistent, and really what is happening here for surfaces remains a question.
Not as good as one.
For polymers, you get a number from, say, first order, and then the second order is a minute correction to that. For surfaces, I think at first order you get an answer which is patently wrong because the fractal dimension is larger than 3. And then you do the next order and you get something that is the fractional dimension around 2.2. And the reason, so there's basically a big gap, or 2.4, and Kai can correct me. There's a big gap. So you have reason not to have that much trust in the theory. And furthermore, simulations here are kind of inconclusive. There are indications that actually the crumple phase could completely disappear in three-dimensional space, and the self-avoidance always gives you a flat object. Okay. So our next attempt over here was to say something like this. Well, this generalized overview was a nice way to do polymers rather than having to go to fifth order or sixth order in perturbation theory of standard field theory to get this exponent to some degree of accuracy. We could already do it more or less with one loop. Can we do something similar for, say, Ising model or all other kinds of ON theory? And so the next thing that we did was we basically constructed theories which generalized the ON model to d-dimensional space. And so our hope was that we could get exponents that were good for the Ising model, XY model, etc., over here. And we did that, so maybe I'll just write down the table because I have 0 minutes left and not describe this theory. You can ask me in private. So
what the model you're generalizing now is just a ON Ising model?
ON is a... Okay, so the model that we start with is the field theory phi alpha of r squared, etc., where alpha is 1 to n. Okay?
Right.
And this model in D dimensions, so in three dimensions you have the Ising model, the XY model, the Heisenberg model as typical examples for n going 1 to 3. And you have an epsilon expansion, the standard epsilon expansion for the U, for this, which is 1 half plus n plus 2 over n plus 8 epsilon over 4 plus order of epsilon squared, which you note at the n goes to 0 limit reproduces the expansion that we had discussed previously. And so our generalization was to give something like this, where we had also n dependences. And by similar optimizing the expansion points, we got some values for the exponents.
But what is D? D is now the dimension of the first quantized.
So this R here runs, oh, this is X, sorry. This actually I should write this as DDR, sorry. So R is R1 through R.
So the normal case is
what is capital D?
What's capital D?
Ah, what is capital D? So, well, okay, what can I?
So, I mean, once on it, capital D is not the dimension of the extended object.
Yes.
Then this.
Okay. Let's take, right, so ON theory, as described over there, is equivalent to, say, unit spins on a lattice, which by a high temperature expansion you can write as 1 plus the sum over all closed loops that don't intersect themselves. And the weight of each loop is some factor, let's say, e to the length of loop. Actually, let's stay discrete. Let's say k to the number of bonds. And you have a factor of n here. And that's why when n goes to 0, you pick up this, because then you have higher order terms like n squared, where you have two of these objects, etc. And so the generalized object is n to the number of loops, k to the number of bonds. So we said, let's generalize this and write an object in D dimensions.
K is the number of bonds and lambda is the number of
couplings. Okay, so in the appropriate version of doing the ON model, let's say on a hexagonal lattice or appropriate lattice, the number of crossings would be exactly zero. So you don't have that factor. But if you want to stay with the 5-fourth model, you would have that. I think as a simplified version, let's say basically these are completely self-avoiding loops. And you could construct a lattice model that has this property. 5-4 theory, indeed, you have to give a cost. So our generalization is a partition function that is 1 plus n times a sum. And rather than doing a loop that closes on itself, we imagine that we have a closed surface. Now, that is D-dimensional. Now, here we have a lot of choices. And really, the only thing that we require is that in the n goes to 0 limit and D goes to 1 limit, we go to the appropriate theories. So here we basically can sum over all self-avoiding these tethered surfaces that I mentioned, or polymerized surfaces, or solid surfaces, with topology of a D-dimensional hypersphere. Because that's the one that we could do.
So you put a single rigid sphere,
right,
and then
it fluctuates, it never intersects itself, and that's one of them. And then at the next order you have two of them.
And you,
right, and then each one of them has a term which is e to the mu, let's say r1 to the d here, e to the mu r1 to the d plus r2 to the d here. and then go. So again,
you could have done it without tethering.
Then I wouldn't know how to do the calculation.
Oh, it's easier to do with tethering.
Yeah. Because, yeah, I mean, that's the one case where I can solve a self-avoiding two-dimensional or d-dimensional manifold is when I have a fixed metric and I don't have to worry about it. I can't do it for fluid members. Maybe the string theorists know it. I doubt it. So that's the one case that he can do. So this is a theory. Then again, we submit this to the referee and they say, well, what's the field theory that generates this? Of course, again, you guys probably know there is no need, and that in fact this thing cannot be generated from a field theory. It's something
this reduces to the old model for what?
Okay, so let's draw yet another diagram here. So our cornerstone has been the polymer theory, which we can get from a theory that is self-avoiding d-dimensional manifolds by taking d goes to 1. And of course, this has not been a unique transformation. We can get the self-avoiding polymer also using the Degen trick of the n goes to 0 limit of the O(n) field theory. And our quest was for the fourth corner of this diagram, something that we call the OND manifold model. And the appropriate limits of it are that when you go take n goes to 0, you actually uniquely go to these d-dimensional self-avoiding manifolds. And when you take the d goes to 1, you go to the field theory, and this again is not unique. And so again, then over, we can reconstruct a diagram like this. So our standard field theories are now living here. They have an additional index n. We know theories that are trivial in this half of the plane, and we know how to extend them perturbatively to this half. And then we have this additional freedom of an expansion point, which we can use to extremize and optimize our perturbative things and get good estimates for our critical exponents. And again, the upshot of the theory is with appropriate tricks, we can get very good exponents, better than what you would get from standard one or two loop epsilon expansions. So again, the sort of, yeah.
So the statement being that there is some theory is O n characterized by n and b, so
yes,
that it expands them, it produces.
Yeah.
And there is an explicit form of Hamiltonian.
No. It's a theory defined in terms of its perturbation series, which is given in this. This is the definition of the theory.
It's defined in the first quantized way, the same way it defines it here. Okay. They're asking now for the string field. But in other words, it's easy somehow, or you are able to do this
as long as, actually the topology of the sphere is not more important. The important thing is the metric being fixed.
Right.
But so if we want...
How do you do it? I mean, the cabinet is not so obvious. Is it right?
Yes. Pardon? We found basically that with the constraints of the limits that we've established here, there was one degree of freedom left. So I can tell you what that is. And basically, suppose you wanted to calculate the partition function of a polymer loop in three dimensions. You would say that the partition function, I can start one corner of the loop anywhere in the volume, so I have a factor of V. Then I have to require the polymers to come back on itself. So the probability that it will come back to itself is 1 over L to the D over 2. But I could have chosen the point that I fixed to be any one of L points on the ring. So I have that. And then if I'm allowing things to expand and shrink with some weight that is proportional to length, I have to do an integration here, which is dl over l, to be dimensionless. Now, when we generalize this to a sphere or a d-dimensional manifold, we had the factor of v. The probability that one corner of a sphere is glued to some point in space generalizes that object to 1 over l to the d over 2, 2 minus d. Any one of l to the d points could have that property. So we had this. And then the difficulty that we had was with our measure of integration. Because should we integrate dl over l, or should we integrate ddl over l to the d? And there is a factor of d difference between these two. And in fact, our measure of integration is undefined up to some factor c of d that in the d goes to 1 limit goes to what you have for polymers. So that's really the one uncertainty that was left, and is this blue arrow that I have over here. And for calculating and estimating exponents, what we did was we fixed the value of d that best reproduced known results for the Ising model in two dimensions, and then used that for the stuff in three dimensions.
Well, I still have some questions, but the time is running out, so let's ask them privately and thank Marilyn.